Welcome to Physicians Off the Beaten Path, a podcast where we've set out to bust the myth that physicians can't venture outside the traditional clinical or research career paths. My name is Shad. I'm a physician and a Harvard MBA and a co-founder of a digital therapeutic startup called Sky Therapeutics.
And my name is Alex. I qualified as an MD in Syria before studying an MBA, computer science PhD, and a master's of bioengineering at Harvard, Oxford, and Stanford. And now I'm building Sky Therapeutics with Shad.
Our guest today is Dr. Sam Kessel. Sam completed his intern year in internal medicine. He served as an associate for multiple angel investing networks, performing due diligence on medical startups part-time during medical training. He then went on to become a consultant at LEK Consulting. He's now an associate at Locust Walk, where he works with a range of biotech companies with cutting-edge technologies, helping them find partners and funding. He hosts the Nucleate Signal podcast and interviews folks who are the next generation of leaders in biotech. He got his bachelor's degree from Tufts University, his medical degree from the University of Virginia School of Medicine, and his MBA from the University of Virginia Darden School of Business. Sam, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to Physicians Off the Beaten Path.
Awesome. Thrilled to be here with you guys. I'm a fan of the podcast.
Great. Really excited for this episode. I've been looking forward to this one. So Sam, for those of us in our audience who may not know your backstory, can you tell us a little bit about how you grew up, your upbringing, why you decided to go into medical school, and then eventually why you went off the beaten path?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born and raised in Worcester, Mass. Always had eclectic tastes growing up, which you'll see plays into my career trajectory as well. Always loved picking up new things. I played multiple instruments growing up, piano and saxophone, grew up in a very musical family. Also enjoyed sports, played tennis, and was swimming as well in high school, for example. And even now to this day, like, I've picked up new hobbies like salsa dancing and beach volleyball. I love trying and learning new things and getting up that learning curve and exploring. I was one of those people who was, from a very early age, focused on medicine. I had my own medical experiences growing up. I had to have multiple surgeries, and part of the reason I ended up in medicine, like many people, is I was inspired by the physicians who treated me, as well as my mom's experience. In college, I studied biomedical engineering because I was really interested in the intersection of technology and medicine, and it was a little bit of an impulsive decision. I only applied to biomedical engineering at one school, and it was, in the summer before college started that I decided to pursue it. But it ended up being a fascinating field to learn about how different biological systems can be engineered to develop new devices, new therapies in general. So always found that fascinating. And that was part of the reason why I ultimately ended up pursuing innovation paths. Engineering ultimately did inform some of my career decisions because of the high focus on innovation. When I was pursuing med school, the idea was I wanted to be an innovative physician. I had a relatively early understanding of what that would be, but I knew that would be at the intersection of technology and medicine. What ended up coming in kind of later on in my college experience was I took a marketing class with a mentor and role model, Jack Derby, and that got me inspired to look at entrepreneurship. How do businesses work? What is the intersection between these three fields of technology, medicine, and business, which is, I would say, still going to be my overall career path as I move forward. So one of the things that happened is when I was in medical school, because of my interest in that marketing class, I was considering an MBA. I got involved with the Entrepreneurship Cup, which is a competition that was university-wide at University of Virginia. And students would come up with ideas for potential startups. And I was working on one with a team where we were focusing on a digital health company that would help bring transparency to pricing of medications. The idea that our friend went to the physician, got prescribed eye drops. They cost $200, and he didn't know that until he went to the pharmacy counter. So the idea was, hey, wouldn't it be great if you could go to the physician's office, based on your insurance, figure out what would that cost of medication be? So the idea that we, mapped out, had a design for, won an early stage concept competition, which helped solidify my interest in business a little bit more. I liked the entrepreneurial spirit of the group. It gave me a little bit of external validation to win that $1,000 prize, even though it was relatively minor. It made me think, oh, like this is something I'm interested in, I like doing, and looks like I'm decently good at. And as I continued on in medical school, I got involved with value-based healthcare research, which I did through the cardiac surgery department, and ultimately decided to pursue the MBA because of those experiences. And during the MBA, got started involved with angel investing and helped advise the university-based angel group called Cav Angels, as well as the local angel group in Charlottesville called Charlottesville Angel Network, where I continued to deepen my understanding of what I liked to do, what I found inspiring in the intersection of medicine, business, and technology, and that ultimately helped inform my career path broader than that. When I left the beaten path was in residency. I pursued internal medicine in part because I thought it was broad. It was going to give me a big picture understanding of all of medicine and allow me to be positioned to connect the dots between medicine, business, and technology at the best level. I was even considering a fellowship. But what happened was intern year COVID hit. And because of that, the original dream of being a chief medical officer got adjusted, and I decided to make a decision to leave medicine in intern year of internal medicine residency. Part of that was push, which was burnout, stress, just not being happy on my day-to-day, in a large part due to COVID. And part of the pull was I had some experience in the Entrepreneurship Cup. I had some experiences doing angel investing and having some early stage interactions with entrepreneurs in the medical device and healthcare space generally that I really enjoyed. While I was in residency, if I did a night shift, I would do 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. in the hospital. And then at 7 a.m., I was on a call with an entrepreneur about their clinical development plan. So there were push factors, there were pull factors that ultimately led me to say, well, wouldn't it be great to be in the business world full time? What could I do to reach my full potential at this intersection? And that's how I ultimately made a decision to pursue consulting. And I ended up at LEK Consulting for 2 years. And now I'm at LocusWalk, which we can get into more later.
Thank you, Sam. That's a great overview of presumably a lot of twists and turns in terms of things that you were interested in. So I really appreciate you distilling it down to the high points. I just wanted to reflect on a couple of commonalities we have. I've actually spent a good bit of time over in Worcester, Mass, working at St. Vincent Hospital. It's one of the many hospitals we would rotate at when I was a surgery resident at BI, and really appreciated Worcester. Really, really good food. That's what I remember, and very good diners. I've also actually interacted quite a bit with Jack Derby. There was a class at HBS called Lab to Market, and we would get paired with numerous products within the Boston ecosystem. And he and my team got paired with him and one of the medical device products that he was working on. And so that was a really exciting experience and exciting class. The last thing I wanted to reflect on is this notion of push and pull. I really like how you sort of explained it, right? Like, there's always some push factors why people leave, and there's always some pull factors as to why you get brought into, you know, a different ecosystem. And sometimes it's primarily push factors and primarily pull factors, but oftentimes it's a combination of both. Just using this framework, thinking about sort of why I, you know, ended up not going back to residency, I think for me it was mostly, you know, pull factors. People say, oh, you must have hated surgical residency. And honestly, I really did like it. I enjoyed being in the operating theater, enjoyed operating, and, you know, some of the other stuff around it wasn't great. But for the most part, I enjoyed it. It's just that I enjoyed what I was doing in business school more. The freedom, the autonomy, the diversity of experiences just pulled me in. And so I really appreciated sort of this pull and push notion. And I think people can think along those lines to figure out what they exactly want to do. You know, my next question was really about, you know, making a change in your career early on. You know, we talked about the fact that in the early stages of your professional career, your journey diverged from the conventional path, for example, working in angel investing or working on different sort of entrepreneurial things that you were interested in on the side. You know, for medical students or residents in our audience who may be very, very busy, but who are interested in investing or entrepreneurship or whatever it is, you know, what advice would you have for them with regards to taking that first step and balancing their clinical duties with their non-clinical interests?
I think to your point, it's a hard balancing act. And it's all about what your priorities are. For me, I'd say, here's what I would say. The first stage is exploration. So reading, talking to people, listening to podcasts like this one or others, right? Like industry type podcasts, try to figure out what excites you. What do you find interesting? When you look, one of the things that I did a lot of was look at people's career paths, whether it was just like reading articles online, and looked at physicians in biotech, which was a really important thing for me, and ultimately reaching out to those people and talking to them, which we can talk more about later. But that was actually hugely influential. So on an exploratory stage, if you're working on, you know, say a surgical rotation, 14 hours, 15 hours, 18 hours a day, that's where maybe when you're walking to and from the hospital or you're commuting, you listen to a podcast in the car and you find it interesting. Great. When you are on your lighter rotations, which there are always ebbs and flows in medical training and in life in general, in terms of your hours, when time is lighter, that's where you can start considering being involved with part-time activities. The cool thing for me for angel investing, which for those of you who don't know, is working with early stage startups, working at like the prototype stage, the initial idea, getting some initial rounds of funding from people who have personal wealth in order to invest. Working with them is quite easy because it's not their full-time job. So it's a great opportunity to get exposure to people who've already had successful careers. Often the people I've worked with are, you know, later on in their careers, they worked for 20 years and now they're investing to help build it, push things forward. And to give back to the next generation of entrepreneurs. So that by nature is part-time, and that's why I'd recommend it. And I think the medical perspective in early stage healthcare startups is very much needed. If you're talking to someone who started a tech company, they're probably not well positioned to tell you if an idea makes sense medically. Often, you know, for some of the startups that come across, if they came out of UVA, they're often healthcare related. And a lot of the people that were involved in, say, Cafe Angels or Charlottesville Angel Network, only a few of them were equipped to analyze things from the medical perspective, from the technical perspective. And this happens in a lot of angel investing. They invest in broad fields, perhaps not ones of their own, but they need that perspective of medical and technical understanding in order to do that. That being said, there's not a ton of part-time opportunities available. Those came about for me by word of mouth. They came from connections, and no one's going to really advertise on LinkedIn or on, you know, an ad board, a like 5-hour a week when you can help type of job. These are mostly things from word of mouth. So it's looking out for example, for angel investing communities in your area. Most major cities have one or multiple. It's looking for startups that you find interesting and connecting with people. And that's where a lot of those opportunities come from. And I would say, I'm sure Shad, for you and as well as for Alex, that some a lot of the opportunities that came about were not official job postings. These were things that came up in the course of things. And I would say if you're at a university like University of Virginia or, you know, a Tufts or, you know, choose your university, there's often a licensing and venture group as part of the university. They often have internships. So looking for those kinds of unique opportunities would be the greatest way to explore that are part-time and gives you some life experience to say whether you like something or not. So it's finding those part-time opportunities that are flexible with your schedule, because there's really no other way around it. As you said, you're going to be very busy, and you have to find something that balances with your medical responsibilities.
Yeah, no, thank you, Sam. I agree with sort of priorities you laid out there. I think the first thing to do, like with almost anything, is to figure out, you know, what excites you. And part of that is maybe sort of dating and doing a couple of internships here and there or spending some time with different people. But ultimately, you have to land on, you know, one or two or three things or whatever it is that really, really excites you. And I say that because, you know, if you find it exciting, you're presumably going to do a better job. And if you do a better job, you're presumably going to, you know, get more and more opportunities. Promotions are going to come. And like you said, you're going to meet the right people, whether it's through word of mouth or networking or whatever it is. I think, you know, sometimes people come to me, you know, audience members from the podcast, and will say or ask things like, you know, how can I be where you are in 5 or 10 years? And I typically think that's not the right way to ask that question. It really is a person-specific journey. And I think at the start of the journey is figuring out what excites you. You can obviously take ideas and advice from mentors and figure out how people navigated different situations. but I really think people have to find what their North Star is. And part of that is finding what really, really excites you. It could be entrepreneurship for someone. It could be consulting for someone else. It could be banking for the third person. So that's really, really important. So I appreciate you spelling that out for us. I think the last question that I had from my side, and you mentioned sort of your work in biotech, so I wanted to spend some time really talking about it. You've worked in this space for quite a while, whether it's from the life science consulting side or on the investment banking side now. And you even have a podcast where you interview biotech leaders. As we know, you know, gone are the days just, you know, small molecules or biologics. Over the past decade or two, a lot has happened in this space, including, you know, gene therapy, CRISPR, CAR-T, ADCs, RNA therapies, whatever it is. More recently, advances in weight loss and Alzheimer's have made, you know, headlines, as has the first, you know, CRISPR therapy that recently got approved in the UK. I'm curious from your vantage point, because you're living it day to day and looking at these companies all the time, what specific advances do you find most exciting with the potential to revolutionize clinical treatment in the, let's say, near future? And are there any early or growth stage companies in the field that you're particularly interested in or closely following?
Yeah, so great question. Like you said, in the near future, I think CRISPR and other gene editing therapies are going to be reaching the market relatively soon, and it can have pretty huge impact. If you look at recent approvals, including, you know, CRISPR in the UK for sickle cell disease, you have uniQure and Roctavian with more traditional adenovirus gene therapies for hemophilia. There are a lot going on with targeted therapies for monogenic diseases. And that's where I think a lot of the gene therapies are going to be playing, at least for the near future. There are some initial ideas for gene therapies for broader diseases, and I think that's something to keep an eye out on, and it depends on how advances continue with genomics for gene therapies for those broader diseases. It's just going to have to be very well defined and characterized, because when you work with a complex disease like type 2 diabetes, which is often familial, it may be complicated to figure out which gene is the most important, and that it's worth drugging with a gene therapy, which are often very expensive. One of the things I think as an enabling technology that I'm quite interested in following, and there are multiple companies in the space, are non-viral gene therapy delivery technologies. That's more longer term. But one of the issues with gene therapies is that you can only dose them once. They may or may not be permanent. There's sometimes concerns with wearing off effects, and that may be after 5 or 10 years, but if patients do need to be redosed, doing it with a viral vector is quite challenging. Never mind the fact that gene therapies are very expensive. So some of these therapies are upwards of $300,000. Some of them, I think Sparks was in the realm of, you know, $750K for Luxturna, I believe. So some of these are quite expensive. And if you can create the therapy and deliver it synthetically, that is something I'm definitely following. Some other areas I think that are interesting are off-the-shelf cell therapies. So that would be companies like Nkarta. I believe Cytomune is also in that space. And they're developing natural killer cells that are allogeneic. So instead of taking someone's own cells out, engineering them and putting them back in, like some of the other traditional cell therapies that are already on the market, looking at ones that are off the shelf. The only issue with that is, are you going to be able to deliver it consistently? Are there going to be adverse events? It sounds great in theory, but in practice, how are you going to be able to deliver those consistently? One area in particular I find interesting is AI as applied to pharmaceutical companies. So looking at companies like Valo Health, which is an integrated pharmaceutical company that uses AI to accelerate their development process. There's been a huge issue that R&D to develop a single drug nowadays is far more expensive than it used to be. Currently, I think the estimate's $2.3 billion to develop a drug from beginning to end. So having new technologies to help accelerate that development pathway using data in ways we didn't think of before, I think is quite interesting. And Valo Health is an interesting company in that space. Going back to obesity, though, a lot of these companies we're talking about, cell therapy, gene therapy, these are really expensive drugs for relatively narrow populations, the way I see it. Ultimately, I'd like to see gene therapy used more broadly in conditions like type 2 diabetes, if there's a way to define that in the future. So that's something I think would be interesting. But obviously, Wegovy, Ozempic, Mounjaro, they're more traditional biologics, and obesity is expected to be a $100 billion market. So I think we need a lot more therapies that are targeting these broader conditions. And I think cardiovascular disease, I think, is due for a newer therapy to help, you know, improve mortality for myocardial infarction or reduce stroke risk. I think there's still room there. Because these are conditions that affect lots of people in the U.S. are age-related diseases and don't have a specific gene associated with them. So we're still going to need therapies that are acting in those spaces as well.
Yeah, thank you for that, Sam. That's really, really helpful. And I was just reading an article the other day, I think on Stat News. It was either Eli Lilly's anti-obesity drug or Novo Nordisk's. I don't quite remember, but they came up with a new study that showed, you know, improvements in not just, you know, weight loss or obesity, but also stroke and a variety of other sort of secondary conditions. What was interesting from that study is that all of the decreased risk wasn't just mediated by weight loss. Some of it they think is more direct anti-inflammatory impacts of the drug itself. So it'll be interesting to see how insurers react to that. There's been some pushback because, as you said, Wall Street has gotten very, very excited at the massive opportunity here. But that also, at least conceptually, may mean there's going to be a lot of cash outflows and utilization risk that falls on the insurance companies, whether governmental or commercial. And so we'll have to figure out where the right balance is as a society. But I'm really excited to follow where this space goes and how reimbursement and adoption shakes out. But thank you for that sort of deep dive into the different areas that you're excited about. Really, really helpful, I imagine, for our audience. That's really it from my side. I'll pass it on to Alex for some questions on his side, but thank you for the conversation so far. Alex, over to you.
Great. Thank you, Shad, and thank you, Sam. Really enjoying the conversation so far. Sam, I want to double click on your experience at LEK and then later at Locust Walk. So LEK is a life science advisory firm, while Locust Walk seems to bring together corporate development, advisory, capital market services, and new co-creation. And so could you actually share with the audience what your day-to-day looks like or used to look like at LEK and what it looks like today at Locust Walk?
Yeah. So LEK is actually a broader management consulting firm, kind of similar to BCG and McKinsey in that they do have everything from automotive through life sciences. They happen to be extremely strong in life sciences, and that was what brought me there in the first place. LEK, in terms of the day-to-day, was in Locust Walk in some ways are quite similar, right? Like compared to medicine, where you're charting, you're seeing patients, you're in the ICU, you're in wards. In the business world, a lot of what I'm doing is, let's say, relatively similar. There's a lot of PowerPoint, there's a lot of Excel, there's a lot of meetings. So in that way, there's similarities between the two. In terms of my day-to-day at LEK, though, the types of problems I worked on were a bit different. So at LEK, often we were working on broader strategy projects. We would help companies, say, make important decisions about which areas to invest in within their company, doing a due diligence on should we buy this company, for example, what would the revenue forecast look like if a drug was launched, what are doctors saying about a drug, how would a drug be positioned in the treatment paradigm, a lot of primary market research. So I was often having conversations with physicians and payers, trying to synthesize the findings from those, put it into a coherent story and help understand the strategy of a company and how that all fit together into a recommendation for what the company should do next. At LEK, I was a day-to-day project manager for a single project, which basically meant I was working with 2 to 3 people, usually below me, an engagement manager above me, and usually 3 or 4 partners on the project. Worked on with really interesting companies. Mid-stage biotechs were often the sweet spot at LEK. Sometimes we worked with big pharmas as well. And we got to work on really interesting conceptual projects. So everything ranging from gene therapy and cell therapy to broader landscapes of entire disease areas. And those were really interesting projects. Often in terms of day-to-day, the difference between medicine and consulting is that consulting was very much Monday through Wednesday heavy. So that could mean early mornings and late night, Monday through Wednesday, Thursdays and Fridays tend to taper off, and very few weekends. So that was the day-to-day at LEK. At Locust Walk, again, similar, PowerPoint, Excel, lots of meetings, sure. The difference is, though, as an associate at Locust Walk, I am the day-to-day manager of multiple projects. So I have to do a lot of juggling, sometimes on 2, 3, 4 projects or deals at the same time. In terms of what Locust Walk does, like you said, it's an integrated corporate development advisory is the way I'd put it. So yes, it's technically an investment bank, and that means we do sometimes financings like raising venture capital for early stage biotechs. That sometimes means, like most of the projects I'm on right now, I'm working on the sell side. So working with a smaller biotech on licensing out or partnering out a drug with a larger biotech or pharma, we often do that kind of work. We do strategy work where we're working with big pharmas and helping them make decisions on what areas should they play in, potential assets to buy, evaluating them, looking at it from the transactability perspective. At Locust Walk, the main difference I would say is it's a bit more action-oriented. At the end of the day in consulting, you create a PowerPoint deck, you make your recommendations, and you hand it to the client. Ideally, you work with them again, but you may not see your recommendations play out. At Locust Walk, a lot of what we do is transaction focused. So you get to help set up a transaction from the early stages, from reaching out to potential partners, framing the story correctly, but we also get to help close the deal. And lucky for me, I got to already close a deal during my experience at Locust Walk. So you have a more concrete output from the work that you do. And that deal was with Ligand for a royalty on tebulizumab. So that's publicly available information. But that was for $20 million. So that was a really interesting deal and really enjoyed working on that one. And I got to work directly with the CEO on that one. One of the big differences in terms of day-to-day too is that Locust Walk is pretty small. There's in total 35, 40 people at Locust Walk versus 1,500 at LEK. So the benefit of working at a small firm is that I will run into our CEO at lunch. I get to work directly with him on projects. Like, that level of visibility is way different than what I was having previously. So it's one of the main draws of my experience at Locust Walk. Now, one thing we didn't touch on yet is the new company creation piece, which I'm very interested in. Part of the reason I joined Locust Walk in the first place is, one, to do deals, but two, to get involved with the new company creation that they're doing. So we are looking to identify interesting targets from the mechanism side and see what's worth pursuing for potentially developing a new asset. We're also interested in platform companies and helping become a co-founder of those companies and ultimately help fundraise for them, create deals for them, and also help them with their general strategy from the very early stages. So the new company creation model is quite interesting. And it's something that I'm in the early stage of getting exposure to, but it's definitely one of the draws for me to get to Locust Walk in the first place. So quite enjoying that so far.
That's awesome, Sam. Thank you for sharing. This is really interesting. I think one of the interesting questions or areas to understand for the audience would be the market gap that a company like Locust Walk is solving. Right? It brings a lot of similarities from consulting companies and investment banks, because in those professional services firms, the teams that are managing different verticals, they see a lot of transactions and they know kind of the best practices on those transactions and they know how to run those transactions efficiently. And usually companies that are on the ground and are encountering a transaction don't necessarily have the accumulated knowledge of those teams. And so I'd love for you to elaborate a little bit more on the market inefficiency that the firm solves. And then kind of branching out of that question, I'd love to understand the strengths that you brought to your two roles as an MD and which parts of the job your teammates looked up for you for guidance, given your clinical experience at the hospital and given your medical experience at med school. So over to you.
Sure. So, all right, we'll take those one at a time. So the first question is where is Locust Walk working in the market? We're often working with smaller biotechs more often than not, although we also work with bigger pharmas. But when we're working with smaller biotechs on the sell side, not many places know how to execute licensing deals and collaboration agreements to think really creatively about potential deal options. So because Locust Walk often works with small companies and biotech, we have like an accumulated knowledge of how to execute very unique creative deal options that not many other banks do. A lot of bigger banks will be working on M&As, big M&As, as well as IPOs, whereas Locust Walk, in terms of the deal types, will be working more on these interesting collaboration agreements. We do also do M&A as well, but that's not as much of our focus. As far as the work for the bigger pharma, so we'll work with mid-stage biotechs, like, you know, market cap north of $10 billion. What we're doing for them is offering a transactability focus to a screen. So for example, if LEK was working with a mid-stage biotech on a due diligence or working on a landscape, it would be from a broad strategic perspective and pretty comprehensive in terms of the research that LEK would do. What Locust Walk would do would be a little bit more narrowly focused on a smaller area, but really deep when it comes to the transactability lens. So not many consulting firms can offer that understanding of deal work that we do every day. And I would say having that deal work perspective definitely informs the way I think about strategy and trying to interpret what is the transactability of an asset that, say, a big pharma is thinking about buying when we're working on those buy-side type of arrangements. For the second question, in consulting, I would say what medical experience offers is excellent communication and listening skills. So because we have experience working with complicated patients who don't want to tell you what's actually wrong and you have to get used to digging in for answers, not so dissimilar from what you're doing in a podcast, but more at a deeper and personal level, you have the ability to connect with people, to understand people, to think critically about a challenging situation. So that applies to teamwork when you're managing people. That applies to specifically primary interviews. When you're doing interviews with physicians, you understand how to communicate with them. You understand their pain points. You know how to think about patient issues in a way that no one else does. So when I was at LEK, people often looked to me to understand what is the patient experience with whatever disease we're looking at. What should we be asking patients to understand what their pain points are? What should we be talking to physicians about to understand how they think about prescribing a medication? Consultants are often wondering what percentage of patients would you prescribe this drug to? And for a doctor, that's a kind of hard question to answer. So making sure you have good follow-up questions, know how to frame a question to someone who's used to seeing 30 or 40 patients a day. How do you think about that from a holistic perspective? Because that's what, because when consultants are trying to build a revenue forecast, they want to know, well, what percentage of patients would you prescribe this new drug X to? And knowing how to frame those questions really carefully, understanding how to do follow-ups and push and pull on certain answers and threads is a really important skill. I would say it definitely impacted my leadership abilities because I'm cool and calm under pressure. The pressure of a impending deadline hardly compares to a patient on the floor who is having chest pain. So in comparison to consulting and banking, which are considered fast-paced fields in the business world, it's quite slow compared to, you know, someone crashing in on room three and you also have to have a new, you know, see a new consult in the ED in 15 minutes. So it really gives you that perspective to be calm under pressure, to interpret data, to be a good leader and communicator. And those are some core skills that are valuable in any field. So that's something where I think the medical perspective is enormously valuable. I'd say at Locust Walk, often that perspective is really important when we're looking at early stage opportunities is, are we solving a really important patient need? A lot of times conversations at Locust Walk and LEK revolve around what are unmet patient needs. And both of you went through medical training, you know, that's not a word we use in the hospital. Like, oh, what are their unmet needs? It's a commercial term. Unmet needs is understanding like, okay, if a patient has a disease, what symptoms or problems or issues do they face on a day-to-day basis that need to be solved and can be solved? So sure, ideally the unmet need is cure the disease. But if you're talking about, let's say, a sickle cell patient, one of their big unmet needs are pain crises. Is there a medication that can help resolve those pain crises or address the pain from those pain crises better? And that's part of what CRISPR is doing. So making sure that when you're looking at an early stage biotech or looking at a major biotech, are they going after a real patient problem and are they addressing the needs that the patients and physicians have? And also making sure you understand those physician workflows. Like a new device, you know, this comes up more in angel investing, a new device that's not practical, you know, physicians and patients aren't going to use. I think there's a lot of startups coming out right now that are like, oh, like, we're going to give physicians granular data of your sleep tracking. Most doctors do not want to know that information. That's overwhelming amounts of information. Most doctors are interested in what is the information we need to make a diagnosis or change in management. And so when these new companies are coming out with these excellent new data trackers or, you know, the Apple Watch that gives you granular minute by minute EKGs over a stretch of years, that information may or may not be useful. And it's understanding what information is useful for a doctor or a patient to make an important decision. So that medical context, when it comes to angel investing, certainly is hugely valuable. So when you're thinking about a technology or a new idea, does this actually solve a problem? Does this have legs? Would a physician actually use this? Will this help patients? So that applies throughout.
That's really cool, Sam. Thanks for sharing. You know, shifting gears to my next question, it's about career planning. And on the podcast, we have a mix of senior folks who have had 20 to 30 years of career experience. And I think those episodes are amazing, and we learn a lot, and the audience learns a lot. And I think when someone is senior, they can look back at their career and see kind of how the linear path evolved. And the reality is that it's also not linear, and I think people recognize that. But once you're that advanced, you have the benefit of hindsight, and you know how everything evolved. And also we have junior folks who are just a few years out of residency or medical school. And I think those conversations are super interesting because you're kind of in the middle of career planning, right? It's questions that you're kind of grappling with every day. And I think those are the same questions that our audience grapples with. And so one of the questions that I want to explore today is, how are you thinking about your own career planning? What's your career vision in 5 to 10 years? What factors are you optimizing for? Why? And what are tangible steps that you're doing today to get there?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, if I was going off my 5-10-year plan from 5-10 years ago, I'd probably be in fellowship at this point. So one thing I've learned through making big decisions is that you have to know yourself to some degree, but introspection has limited ability. I think some of the steps that I talked about on one of your first questions is really helpful to think about. When making career decisions, the first step is explore. What moves you? What excites you? For me, that's the intersection of medicine, business, and technology. That's taken a lot of ways. For me right now, that interest is in the early stage, new companies, understanding how they work, understanding how deals get done, ultimately how are companies built and how are their strategies decided. The short answer is I don't have a definitive answer where in 10 years exactly I'd like to be. Some people say, like, I want to be exactly at this position. I think someday, you know, I would consider being a CEO of an early stage company and starting my own company. I think I could also see myself doing that from a platform like Locust Walk, which is building new companies all the time and having a very unique, broad perspective. So the short answer is I'm exploring still, and every day I talk to people who are ahead of me, and that's how I've made a lot of my career decisions. Is, you know, someone like Alex Harding was important for me. I talked to him when I was in business school. He's the, going back to CRISPR, he is the head of business development for CRISPR. I talked to him 3-4 years ago when I was still in business school. I asked him what his perspective was. At that time, he was in venture capital. I asked him, Alex, how did you make your way from medicine to venture capital? And modeled some aspects of that into my own career path. And so that's why I ultimately chose consulting, for example. And, you know, it was partly inspired by him that I was interested in the deal side and business development side of biotech. And that's what brought me here in part today, as well as discussions with other mentors and advisors as well. So it's about exploring, trying things, collecting data, and ultimately making decisions as you go. So I was at LEK, I was enjoying some of the deal-related work I was doing there. I was interested in pursuing business development further. Locust Walk was not intentional. I was looking into business development type jobs, and I had a reach out on LinkedIn, and I ultimately pursued that. So it was one of those things where I knew a general area that I was interested in pursuing, and I evaluated an opportunity as it came along. I think the things I'm optimizing for are doing interesting and compelling work, which for me means getting to think about strategy, getting to think about the future of medicine and how I can shape that to some degree to ultimately bring new therapies to market that improve patients, therapies that are available to them, ideally extending life, and I'm pretty focused on that, and specifically within oncology is an area I'm particularly passionate about. And focusing on that North Star, Chad, that you talked about earlier on is focusing on what therapies I think are interesting, working at that cutting edge, hopefully creating a vision where patients can live longer lives, specifically for cancer therapies, and in helping shape that. 10 years, I don't know exactly what life will bring, but I hope to still be in this early stage biotech field. And if not, it's because I found something new along the way that I enjoyed. So whether it's being more deal focused exclusively as I grow, or being more on the mature end of biotech, we'll see what life has in store. At this stage of my career, I'd say I'm pretty work focused. I'm fine working many hours per week. I'm fine plugging in on the weekend. I probably will have to work this weekend. But later on, when I have a family, I'm sure the parameter may change. I think I recommend for anyone in your audience, Designing Your Life is a great book. It has tons of frameworks and tools to think about. One that helped me at different inflection points was regret minimization framework. I don't think that's actually from Design Your Life. That's from Tim Ferriss, actually, the regret minimization framework. But ultimately for me, like when I was deciding what to do after medical school, is like, I would regret not practicing medicine. I really want to make sure I practice medicine. And that's part of the reason why I pursued internal medicine residency. And then ultimately I realized when I was in internal medicine residency is more of a push-pull kind of thing, set of activities going on. And I said to myself, all right, I'm pretty drawn to the business world, and I think I'd regret not making the shift now. And that's ultimately what helped me switch to LEK. So regret minimization is a great framework. Taking time to assess where you are, explore different fields, gather data, and make the decision as you go along is kind of how I've been going about things. So there's not one thing I'll do in 10 years, and I'm excited to see where that path takes me.
Sam, that's awesome. I really like how exploration and iteration focused your planning approach is. And I think it requires a good level of humility, flexibility, and vulnerability to do that and to execute that well. I appreciate that. And to finish us off here, how can our audience follow your work? What are the best channels? And do you have any parting thoughts?
So please follow me on LinkedIn. You can direct message me, and I'm more than happy to respond there. I try to do my best to respond quickly, but sometimes I get overwhelmed. So I'll try to get back to you in 1 to 2 weeks. Please follow the Nucleate Signal podcast, where we talk to biotech entrepreneurs, academics, and investors to check out there if you're interested in learning more about the biotech world. One parting thought, speaking of LinkedIn, is networking is a crucial skill that I think is not well developed by most medical schools, and it will impress you on what it can do. Whether you're interested in staying in the medical world or potentially leaving it, talking to people and reaching out to people who are further along in their journey, if you're a medical student talking to a resident or even an attending, most people are happy to talk about their careers. So have a set of questions ready to go. Try to learn about how they made their decisions and ended up where they are, and try to take some lessons from that. Model some aspects of their life path and career into yours. LinkedIn is a tool I think is not well understood for medical doctors, but it has been extremely influential for me. So I've reached out to mentors, like I mentioned earlier, Alex Harding, who's another physician in biotech. He was hugely influential to me, and I still stay in touch with people like him. It's helped me get in touch with the former head of Medicare and Medicaid through the Senate under George W. Bush, which has been hugely influential to me as well. So reach out to people. You'd be shocked at who's going to respond, and you can learn about their career path and have an informal conversation. I can be one of those people. Wishing you all the best of luck on your journeys.
That's awesome. Thank you, Sam. Really great conversation today. Chad, that was a great conversation with Sam. I really enjoyed it. And my takeaway for that conversation would be around Sam's reflection that he did not feel that medical training and medical school equipped him well enough to identify unmet needs in healthcare, and that once he transitioned to industry, he had to learn how to think in terms of identifying unmet needs. And I think it's a very important takeaway because unmet needs in general are part of the broader design thinking paradigm, which essentially aims to build tools and mental frameworks to identify user needs and pain points. And I think it is a design thinking and identifying unmet needs is a mental framework that is very important for clinicians and medical students who are interested in healthcare innovations to develop, because as clinicians, we are on the front lines of clinical delivery and clinical service. And I think that allows you to identify and observe and see, experience firsthand those unmet needs. And I think having the mental framework of identifying those needs and thinking about them is very important, because think about it, if you're a comedian, you can see the small comedic moments in pretty much regular everyday interactions that other people may not recognize. And I think there's an analogy here where if you're able to develop this mental framework, this ability to think in terms of unmet needs, you can start identifying those unmet needs and thinking about different solutions for them, especially that as physicians, we're really well positioned to identify them just because of our interactions with patients and navigation of the complex healthcare ecosystem. And I think in general, some of the very helpful resources that I found really essential for design thinking are the materials, the publications, and the website of the Stanford Biodesign Center. They have a lot of free content out there, and I've had the chance to participate in one of their programs, and it was a great experience. And I think the other set of resources come from the design thinking consulting firm, IDEO, I-D-E-O. They also have a bunch of very helpful free content. So highly recommended, and I think that stood out to me as takeaway. Over to you, Shad.
Thanks, Alex. Great takeaway. I completely agree. This was a really interesting discussion with Sam, and there's a lot of sort of frameworks to highlight. I think one concept that I really liked that Sam mentioned is this notion of push and pull factors. I think this is really helpful because you can look at where you're working right now, and you can sort of list the pull and push factors. You know, what is keeping you in this space? You know, it could be passion, it could be money, prestige, and a variety of other factors. What about the push factors that are trying to push you out? Maybe it's the people that you're working with, or maybe it's the work hours, or you know, whatever it is. And I think identifying the push and pull factors and then sort of trying to understand each of those factors' true importance to your life can help you, you know, figure out if your current path is the right path and if you're in it for the right reasons. Then you can also look at a space that you may want to move into and try to identify the pull factors and the push factors there. I think you can do it even if you haven't spent a lot of time in that space by chatting with individuals and by doing research. But of course, having some personal experience is very helpful. For example, I remember during business school, I did a little bit of consulting, some venture capital, some entrepreneurship, as well as coming from a clinical background. And when I was trying to understand my next steps after business school, I did an informal, you know, push and pull factor analysis. And I just liked, you know, Sam mentioning this framework because it becomes an easy way to always pressure test your decisions rather than just being passive and doing something because you've always done it. I think one last thing is that, you know, even after you've made your decision as to what you want to pursue, doing something like a push-pull factor analysis every, let's say, 6 to 12 months can be helpful just to ensure that you're still on the right track. So I just thought that was a very illuminating example of something that can be used in real life to sort of ensure that you're on the right track. With that ends our episode with Sam. For our audience, remember to follow us on social media on LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube at POTBP Podcast, and to catch our latest podcasts on your favorite podcast platform. To get in touch with us, you can always email us at physiciansoffthebeatenpath@gmail.com or visit our website at POTBPpodcast.com. We volunteer our time and money to make this content freely available. If you enjoy our content and find it helpful, you can always support us by buying us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/POTBP podcast. That's buymeacoffee.com/POTBP podcast. See you guys next time.